I would like to acknowledge the Quandamooka people, the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast was recorded, and to pay my respects to their elders past, present, and to those emerging. I am fortunate to be able to spend much of my lifestyle outside on the land of the longest living storytellers in the world, and I am grateful for their ongoing care and connection to the land and the waterways. I do my best to respect this land by treading carefully and acknowledging the beauty when I'm working and playing on country. Tess Rowley is an author, children's books about child protection, and a self-published her first adult book last year. She's an extraordinary woman who has a wonderful sense of humour. The chat went a little bit longer than usual, as Tess was so interesting. And make sure you hang around for the end when Tess shares her hilarious poem about Cadbury's. Enjoy getting to know Tess. Hi, Tess, and welcome to the Women of Winter Manly podcast.
Oh, thank you, Alana.
So I always ask my guests the questions of what do you love about the Bayside and how did you get here?
Right. Well, I've always wanted to live by the water, and apparently creative people do. They have this pull to the water. Oh, I suppose greenery too, but mine was definitely water. And so when I met my partner, Richard, he asked me what my dreams and goals were. And the first thing I said was I wanted to write a pop song that made the charts.
Oh, okay.
And the second was I wanted to live by the water. And so when we first bought our first house, you know, 30 years ago, it was not on the water. we were looking for the cheapest house possible, but it was near the water in Manly West.
Okay.
And we used to ride our bikes down to the Esplanade. And a few years later, I was thinking, how could we improve that little house we'd got, because it sort of had almost been built back to front. And a real estate agent just happened to say to me, it was Richard felt that possibly it wasn't worth the work, that there's a little cottage on the Esplanade that's been for sale for 7 months, and it might be exactly what you're looking for. Because, you know, we were trying to possibly consider building upwards so we could see the sea across the treetops. And there she said, there's a little cottage, it could be waiting for you.
And it was on the market for 7 months waiting just for the right people.
Waiting for us, yeah. So we came and bought it, and so 25 years, and never looked back. But, of course, we were battlers. We were the last of the battlers to come on the Esplanade because, of course, the prices have gone up since then. But I just love the serenity of Wynnum, which is starting to sound like the castle, isn't it?
The serenity.
But it is beautiful. And when I say serenity, it's just that sort of feeling of restfulness. And it's not cutthroat, competitive. You know, there's people walk their dogs past our house, people in wheelchairs from the special school at Darling Point. Yeah. We've just got this beautiful array of people that sometimes wave to us if we're sitting eating our breakfast. And I just think it's the best to a Queensland country town you could possibly get that still gets you to work in the city when you need to go to work.
Yeah, and you would see it all just on the Esplanade itself. You'd sit out there and watch the Bayside go past.
That's right.
How much has the real estate changed around, like just the type of houses in 30 years you would have seen?
Yes, and it's such a shame because I think there's been not enough preservation of these little cottages, and we just know that our sweet little cottage, when the next person buys it, we'll just knock it down, build a big high-rise that doesn't really fit the scenery. I would have loved to have seen more of those little cottages left for that lovely seaside feeling it's got.
They do still have that feeling when you walk past
ours. Yes, ours is a sweet little cottage that probably will remind you of Grandma's cottage. And in actual fact, I am a grandma. So
tell me, what were you doing 30 years ago when you moved to the water?
Yeah, well, I've worked for most of my career. I've worked in child protection in the city, and starting off working in Coalface in child protection and then graduating to a new centre that opened called the Centre for Prevention of Child Abuse. And so one of the needs of me as a professional was working with other professionals as to how can we help prevent child abuse. Mm. So working with schools, with dentists, talking about marginalised patients and understanding behaviour patterns of a child who might be being abused so that children can be better protected, but also to community groups as to how can we help that family that's really struggling. Because I don't believe most parents want to harm their children, But I think if the skills and information are missing and a few other problems come along like unemployment or ill health, then children may get hurt and do get hurt. So how can we become a better community where we can support someone who's struggling rather than pointing the finger?
Yeah, just like the parents. It's such a good approach, isn't it?
Yes.
I think a lot of people who aren't, because I've worked in child protection as well, and people who haven't been exposed to it, I don't think people always understand that it is that whole model of community that protects a child, isn't it?
Yes, that's right, yes. And often, you know, I would say to some of my clients, I'm just a mum like you, you know. I don't get every day right. And there's some days you look back on and wish you could do it again. But, you know, I used to say, come on, let's do some work together.
Yeah.
Because I can't believe you laboured for however many hours to get this baby out. To be an unkind mother. I'm sure you want to be a good mum.
Yeah.
And I've still held that firm belief when I left. You know, I really had some clients who I so admired. Because if you scratch the surface and ask about their childhood, it's always been pretty grim.
Yeah.
I've been astounded at how well a job they're doing. I'm not sure if I could have done such a good job.
Yeah, with their own adversity that they were facing.
That's right, yes.
So how did you get into that work in the first place?
Oh, well, I went back to university because I left school at 15 and I was a hairdresser, which was a great trade to have because when I first went out and prac with a senior social worker, she commented how good I was with people. I said, oh, yeah, no, I used to be a hairdresser.
Of course, I'm your apprenticeship.
Yeah, that's right. But I've also always been a writer. And so when I went into the Centre for Prevention of Child Abuse, they were really wanting someone to write books for children about messages, it's okay to say no, and also books for parents. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of almost fell into the job because of my writing skills and also the fact that I've always been an interested public speaker. Some of my work is poetry. And so I seized every chance I got to go and say poems when my children were small and I couldn't be in any little amateur theatre group, but I'd go off anywhere at night time just for the free supper and also a group of lovely women and say a few poems and sometimes a group of men and women. I don't write particularly just for women, but most of my stories in poetry are about just everyday things and so, you know, they do tend to be more feminine just because I'm a woman.
Yeah. Wow. So you worked, so how? What age were you when you went back to uni then?
I was in my late 20s, early 30s, yes, because I had my first child at 22, which nowadays is regarded as quite early, but when I was married at 19, and so it was not unusual to have a baby in your 20, 21, but I was 22 when I had my first daughter.
Yeah.
And
So how was that? So you went back in your late 20s to do social work? Was it social work that you...
Well, the first thing I had to do was go to night school. And I went to Corinda High School and did year 11 and 12.
Yeah.
And then I started off my first year doing journalism.
Wow.
But when the teacher saw me a year later and asked me why I wasn't still doing it, I said, no, it was wrecking my writing.
It says something about journalism, doesn't it?
I didn't realise how cheeky it was, but he did. He said, oh, that's cheeky. So I sort of stumbled into it. And for my first job was working as a family support worker. Mm-hmm. And so I did sort of stumble into it. And then this next job in QCPCA, Centre for Prevention, it was just absolutely, the glove fitted perfectly because I was able to write, public speak, maintain educational resources for other groups and I had statewide responsibilities, so there was a lot of travel.
Yeah.
And some of my work took me into far north Queensland working with the Indigenous community where I discovered that a lot of their culture is very much don't get too big for your boots, which was very much my Yorkshire culture too, and don't step outside your station in life, which was I'd been impressed on when I was a teenager because we were working class family, you know, get out, get a job. 15 years of age.
So I want to get to writing, but tell me about I probably would be remiss of me not to ask about when did you come to Australia? Like you were born in Yorkshire?
I was born in Yorkshire, I left England when I was 19, newly married, went to New Zealand, 5 years. It was a job that my husband went to and then to Sydney and then to Brisbane. And but that marriage lasted 27 years, not too bad. And then we parted, and I have now repartnered with my partner now.
Wow. So it's a long journey to get to the Bayside then. Long journey.
Especially when you're raising children. I know that anyone listening to this will be aware that when you're raising children, you don't have much money to spare, which gets back to my writing. When I first started writing books for the department, I said, you know, we've really got to keep the costs down, because I wanted them to be either giveaways or so cheap that anyone can
affordable.
Afford them. Yeah, because when my children were growing up, we used the library a lot because I couldn't afford the books. And in fact, one book, which was a red hot favourite, a Dr. Seuss book, I hand wrote the whole thing into a scrapbook as we kept borrowing it again and again and again, and because my children loved it. So I hand wrote the whole thing and illustrated.
So you've always loved writing, obviously. And so landing that job in the centre, so you wrote resources. So the books that you've got, the children's books, picture books, were they resources that you wrote for your position that you're in at the time?
That's right, yes. In fact, those books are now out of print, unfortunately. But there were little books, and I wrote them so that they were small enough to fit into a child's pocket, because I thought if we're writing about, for example, it's okay to say no type messages. I didn't want any child to feel they were stigmatised by having this book on site, so they could pop it into their pocket. But at the same time, because the size of the paper was very small, it was cheap. So back then, you know, they were selling them for a dollar.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's in the 80s, 1980s. And they were giving them away at the same time. But the whole purpose of writing for not-for-profit organisations is that some of that money does go back into the next reprint. And so it's not that they don't need to make a profit, because they need to make some money
to keep
print
going.
The next lot. And so when I left the department, they did give me back my intellectual property so that I could print the ones that were out of print. And so one of them, Touches and Feelings, which is middle primary, I have printed myself, because some places, like a hospital in Orange in New South Wales, buy them in bulk for programs they run on messages keeping children safe from sexual abuse. Unfortunately, the next few books I started writing for agencies, schools were starting to say, can we have them bigger so that the teacher can actually sit it on there and then face out to the... So we did start going bigger, and unfortunately then the price starts creeping. So one book, which I wrote for Family Planning Queensland, called Everyone's Got a Bottom, was probably the biggest book I've written. And by the way, I don't have a say in an organisation that I write a book for in what they charge. So this one started at $20 and it's now $25. But it is a much bigger book. And it's just at the moment I've been given back the intellectual property of Everyone's Got a Bottom. So I'm about to reprint, and we've got it to an A4 size, which is a bit cheaper to post. All these things I have to keep in mind now, because suddenly it's mine
it's
to
yours.
Distribute.
And
so the artist, Jodie, and myself have got the book size a bit more in favour of being able to post it for the lesser money.
So how do you go about working with, just intrigued, so Family Planning Queensland, do they approach you or do you approach them? So how does that work?
No, how it works is that I think word got around, because I've probably written 10 books and then some
related to that subject
along
matter.
Those lines of self-esteem and knock knock who's there, child has been sexually abused, wants to tell someone, so starts with a knock knock joke and finishes with a knock knock joke. But of course the centre part is sensitive and serious. However, as a mother, I've never written anything for children that would scare or frighten them or give them more information than they need to have. I'm really absolutely serious about that parents will often say, oh, I don't know whether my child's ready for this book yet. Everyone's Got a Bottom is one example. And you know, I say, look, I always write with my own children in mind, that it's a book that would not give them scary information. I don't want children to think that there's a bad person on the corner of every street. That's not the message at all. And if anything, I want parents to know that the people that you need to be most observant of are quite often family members or the babysitter or someone who you regard as a friend or a relative.
Yeah. It's information that's important. It might not be on every corner, but it happens.
That's right, yes. But the time when it is a stranger is very much the exception, very much the minuscule exception. And I've always said that that's really when evil meets opportunity. And a child is either abducted, and I'm not sure whether we can ever protect a child from that vandalism or exploitation.
Random,
Yes, because it's so minuscule. Yeah. I would hate to scare a child because basically the world is a good place, and most people are good and want to help kids.
Yeah.
And I'd much prefer children to know that message, but at the same time to have enough resilience that if they were about to be exploited, it might put that perpetrator off because this child looks a bit more resilient.
Yeah, and some protective factors in place.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Not with little children, but as children mature, some of those protective factors can be put in place just with an ongoing conversation with children.
Excellent. So so family planning, they approached you and said...
That's called a commission, and so they ask if, because I have to write it obviously outside my job, and at the time I was working, in fact I was working part-time by the time I wrote Everyone's Got a Bottom, so I was working 4 days a week at another organisation, a Catholic organisation, and so they asked me to write the book, asked me what my fee was, and I quote from the beginning of the concept of what they want me to write about, right up to going to print. So I love to work with the artist. Some books I don't get a chance to. The organisation has their own in-house artist, and so I don't get a lot of say. But whenever I can, I love working with the artists, and because I'm a very visual writer, and I often can see what is meant to be. For example, one book I wrote for Now Save the Children, it used to be called Good Beginnings, but they've combined with Save the Children, and it was a book for children who had a father in prison. And so I worked with an artist who, when she showed me the picture, I just commented that the father looks a bit old for how I'd imagined it. I felt we needed a younger father, and I said he looks more like 40, so I said, can we have him somewhere else, in that he could be a prison guard, or because I respect artists' work, it was beautiful, but just a tattoo on. And she's gave me a little bit of a grin and said, well, actually, it's my dad. Oh. So I've hit the nail on the head, he was 40. And
she's a good artist.
And so I said, well, would he mind being a prison guard? or even a prisoner. But she, and then gave me a lovely young dad, which was more in keeping
with what the story was.
And I even say things to some artists if I get a chance to work with them. And this was another one for the prison book. I said, look, and I just want mum to look ordinary. You know, she can have fat ankles or something like that. No, I don't want Barbie doll. Yeah. just like we all look, you know.
Like real.
Yeah, that's right. When we've had a couple of babies, you know, just an ordinary mum whose husband has done something wrong and he's gone to prison, and she now has to face the children and tell them that dad's in prison. And it just gives children a voice when you're touching on those hard-to-talk-about subjects, because most of the books I write are sometimes hard-to-talk-about subjects, although since in the last couple of years I've retired, I'm writing books now that are more generic. So at the beginning of COVID, I wrote a book about friendship. And it was after a raft of terrible murders, of domestic violence situations where the wife's left and then the husband is enraged and harms the children and the wife. And I was so moved by one particular horrible murder that I thought, I need to write a book about friendship for all children so that we can catch them early and start to give them the idea that friendship's about letting go. And so I had the idea in my mind, and I'd started to just sketch a few ideas of what I wanted to write about. And then the Centre for Women in Logan approached me and asked me if I'd write a book for them. Was I still writing books? And I said, oh, I'd love to. And they then said the magic words, do you have any ideas?
Well, let me think about that.
That's right. So, they really liked the idea of friendship. And so my friend Gordon came about. And you can get it from the Centre for Women, or you can borrow it from the library. Yeah. But it's a really delightful book, just about being a good friend. And in fact, I rang childcare centres to float the idea, and was I on the right track and was there anything else I should be including? And every time the childcare worker would say to me, oh, working with preschoolers, they're best friends one day and probably play solid for 3 days, never leaving each other's side, and then suddenly the child wants to go off with another friend. So child number two is out for World War III, revenge. And she said it's such a major issue that we really need something.
What a nice lesson.
That says, letting go. And so what I've said in my little forward in the book is I'd love to think that there's a constant refrain going through it, that then I remembered Gordon. Gordon, by the way, is a dog, a rescue dog. And so I'd like to think that when your children are teenagers and your boyfriend goes off with your best friend and you're out to stab them both, that mum might say, hey, remember Gordon? Let him go. Let him go. Wish them well, because there's lots of other boys, and who knows, one day you might get back together again. And don't let yourself down. And so it's an ongoing message that I think we can give children.
We need to start early, though, don't we?
Preschool. I think we need to start saying letting go, and also being kind and gentle with each other instead of yelling and carrying on.
Yeah.
So this little My Friend Gordon just has little messages throughout.
I like that.
Yeah, no,
like
it's a lovely little book.
Yeah.
In fact, I fall in love with all of my books. I hold them to my chest.
And so you've written one only quite recently. So tell me about your latest one.
Well, my latest one's an adult book, actually. There is another children's book last year, Odd Socks, which I wrote for Key Assets, about difference. That's difference and diversity.
Nice.
And that's middle primary.
Yeah.
But my latest book for adults is Remembering Nazareth House, which I wrote because I met some women in my work in the centre when I was looking at volunteers for child abuse prevention speakers and helpers. And a lady came in to meet with me to talk about being a volunteer. And my first preamble was always, that there'll be some training about understanding what child abuse is, because there's no question that we stick all the child abusers in one corner, in the naughty corner, that we all at times get it wrong. We probably don't get it as extremely wrong as some parents, but we all get it wrong. So we talk about child abuse. Well, before I'd finished, this lady said, can't tell me anything about child abuse. I was in an orphanage in Wynnum, and I was there in the 1940s, 1950s, from a baby to 17, and I know all about child abuse. And she started to tell me her story. And on the way out, she turned around and said to me, did you believe all that stuff I told you? And I was quite shocked. I said, of course I believed you. And she said, well, you're the first person I've ever told. And she would have been probably 40.
How powerful.
Yeah, and so she then got in touch with me a few days later and said that some of the other women wanted to know if they could come and tell me their stories. And I wasn't able to do it as my job, so I agreed that I would meet one weekend and we'd get together and talk. And 15 women turned up. One lady had come from Sydney, some from the Glasshouse Mountains, and talked about their childhood at Nazareth House.
And they're all still connected, obviously.
Well, this is the amazing thing, is that in those days they weren't allowed to speak to each other at Nazareth House, so there was no friendships formed, and friendships were almost a secret if you did make a friend, and even then you'd be ridiculed. And so when this particular lady left Nazareth House at 17, there was no going away party or anything, she just left. And, of course, no mobile phones in those days, in the 1950s. But she just bumped into people that she recognised in supermarkets or, waiting for a bus. And so she just reconnected through pure accident. But the interesting thing is they never talked about their childhoods. Not one of them had ever shared with each other. Wasn't it horrible? They were all just getting on with their lives. How many kids have you got? Who are you married to? Are you divorced now?
It's like that 17 years didn't exist.
Yes, they'd never talked
to anyone
about
else.
It. So this day at the gathering at the lady number one's house, Bobby, was amazing, because it was the first time they'd ever all come together, and it was also the first time they'd ever spoken about it. And
they did that collectively.
They did it collectively. So to start off with, I arrived, and some of them had arrived early, and they'd got a couple of cooked chooks, and they were making sandwiches, and all was jolly, and falling over each other in the kitchen because it was pretty cramped, as you can imagine. And then we sat down, and the stories began, and it was like the most amazing emotional time. And when I came to leave, the ladies asked me if I'd write. They knew I wrote children's stories, so they said, "Will you write a book about us?" And I think I must have been high on emotion because I said yes, and I'd never at that stage written an adult book. So it's taken me over 20 years to write it because I just kept starting and stopping, and I kept waving it past, you know, is this right? No, you've made a mistake there. That wasn't quite how it was. And so I wrote the story and then had the luck of being given a residency at Queensland Writers' Centre 3 years ago. And I took this manuscript because I'd tried so many times to get it published and made so many changes. So the residency allowed me to use this manuscript as with my mentor that I was afforded at the Queensland Writers' Centre to say, look, I'm struggling with this. I'd really like to have it finished before quite a few of the women had died in the meantime because they were all very frail and fragile even in their 40s. Mm. Their childhood was definitely represented on their face and their body language. Yeah. My mentor, Sandra, said something wonderful. She said, you have to say to them, it's speculative. You have to speculate what they said to each other or what they might have even thought about each other to bring it to life. It's called a speculative memoir. Mm. I'd never heard the words before, but it was the magic formula. So I rang the main character in the book, who I'm still in touch with, we're still good friends, and I said, speculative, and she gave me permission. She said, look, go for it.
It doesn't have to be.
Go for it.
So was that holding you back, do you think, thinking I'm not going to represent them, I don't know what they're thinking, I'm not going to be able to represent
them
right?
That's right, yes. Well,
so it's even a blocker.
Even when I thought I knew what they were thinking, they'd tell me off.
So you were wrong.
In fact, there was this one rule that they had to have their arms folded across their shoulders when they went to sleep at night. They weren't allowed to put their hands under the covers. Now, Wynnum gets pretty cold at night time, and especially Nazareth House, which is high on a hill, and some of the dormitories were open dormitories. So imagine that cold wind. Mm. So at one stage, I'd got one little character with her hands just creeping down under the covers and between her knees to keep her hands warm. And I sent that draft off. I think if she could have strangled me down the phone, she would have. Because she was adamant. I never, ever put my hands under the covers. I never put them between my knees. I wouldn't do it then and I would not do it now.
You were told.
And so I said, sorry, I'll take that bit out. But I said, you know, I was just trying to bring some warmth into you, a little girl. And I said, you know, I told her when we had hot water bottles as kids, we always put it between our knees.
I guess for her, she just didn't have that warmth. So I can see why she would say, don't pretend it was warm to make it nice.
Yes, that's right. So remembering Nazareth House finally emerged as a speculative memoir. Mm. And interestingly enough, the first print run, we gave a lot away because the notion was always, and it was through the National Reader Scheme, I couldn't get a publisher. No one was interested. In fact, one publisher said, no one wants to read about that. That's old hat. And I just remarked back that I am at the moment reading a book about the First World War.
Yeah, it's really
odd. But anyway, thankfully through the Redress Scheme grant, it was edited and published. And released at the State Library, Queensland Writers' Centre in the State Library. And all the women still alive came to the launch. And if the ones who had passed, their family members got a copy.
Lovely.
So I gave a lot away. And then I was left to try and sell the rest so that we could put that money back into the next reprint run. And I managed to sell 5 in Wynnum at the Gigglefit Grammar on Bear Terrace. The other bookshops, it was late September last year, too close to Christmas. They didn't need any new stock, so I wasn't having much luck. But one woman read it. She must have bought it. It was the one book that probably sold that week from Gigglefit Grammar because just a few days later, one woman read it and then posted on Facebook that it was a moving book. She couldn't put it down. It was well written. Mm. And as a result, people started saying on Wynnum What, where do we get it from? Yeah. Where do we get it from? And thankfully, I have a friend, Judy, who knows all about Facebook because I don't. And she started saying, I'll get a copy. I'm seeing her on Tuesday and I'll get you a copy. Come to my place. Mm. And so by the time we met on the Tuesday, Judy said, I've sold 10 copies. And by the end of the evening, she'd sold 20 copies, and that was a Tuesday night, and by Friday we'd sold out.
Oh, wow.
Completely.
Wow.
So then we had to post on Win & What that if you still want a copy, we're getting them reprinted.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we put the sales money, we had to top it up with our own money, but I assured Richard we wouldn't lose the house.
The cottage is safe, Richard.
So we, in that town, we printed 500 copies, which was allowed us to sell the book for $25, and then other bookshops took it because it was going crazy in Wynnum area. Yeah. And in 12 weeks, we sold 1,200 copies. We kept printing more every time we were looking like we're selling out. Yeah. But really, I have to say thanks to Judy, because Judy does Facebook, and I'm a bit of a dinosaur, I'm ashamed to say.
She got it started. Well, and it's such an important story. Like, it's such an important part of Wynnum, but also just of the era and what... how people were treated then.
Yes, yes. And I've had marvellous feedback from people saying that once you're believed, and this was not a woman who was in my story, she was from a different orphanage, but she sent me a Facebook message saying, once you're believed, healing starts. And she thanked me for writing this story because it represented her story. And in fact, Bob Atkinson, who's the former police commissioner, he's written the foreword for the book.
Oh, wow.
He was part of the Royal Commission into institutionalized abuse right around Australia. And when he read my manuscript before it was published, he said that it needs to be published because it's everybody's story in Australia. Everywhere he went, he heard these stories. Yep. So it's not just a Catholic orphanage, it's Presbyterian,
Salvation Army. Not just this location.
So I'm certainly not getting at any religious denomination. I'm certainly very respectful of the good that they do, but I think we also have to acknowledge the history of what happened in orphanages back then.
Yeah, yeah. And the pain that it caused people. The pain that it caused people, I think, is important for people to know.
Yes.
And those women's stories to be told is a real gift that you're giving, isn't it?
Yes, yes, that's right. Yes, I always say that when I'm asked to write a book, they're allowing me to use my gift. Yeah. It's not that I'm smart, because, you know, I'm not that smart, actually. Still haven't fathomed Facebook. Thank you, Judy. And come out to Judy.
We've all got strengths in different areas.
That's right. Yeah. But the thing is, I do have the gift of writing. Mm. And I think with any gift, we shouldn't be shy about it. Because I don't know what I did to deserve it. Mm. But that's what gifts are, aren't they? And I'm able to use it. So that is just a real blessing.
Absolutely. If you've given a voice to people that didn't have a voice previously.
But then I do get the harvest of when people say, that really moved me. Or it gave me a deeper understanding of what happens when there's nobody looking out for the kids, which is what happened in those days. You know, in the story, the main character tried twice. She ran away to the police station in Wynnum and told the policeman, you know, they lock us up in dungeons and in a dungeon. And the policeman said, there's no such things as dungeons now, you know, and drove her back to that sort of town.
She was just a little girl.
Just a little girl, you know, wanting I don't know what, and fairy story ending. And so there wasn't the same understanding. And also I firmly believe that a lot of the, because I've even heard elderly women say, you know, who were sexually abused by their father who happened to be the Anglican priest, that she had gone, she was in her 80s when she told me, and this is quite a few years ago now, but she, Queensland country town, gone to the police station to say what her dad was doing, and he never did anything. And so she was telling me, probably in her 70s, what had happened when she was a child and how she'd never told her husband, you know, that she'd been sexually abused and she was not a virgin. And I said to her, you know, look, in fairness to that young policeman in a Queensland country town, he probably didn't have any idea what to do with the information you were giving him. And so I can understand that he would have thought, you know, he's the Anglican priest, you know, what do I do?
It just wasn't talked about. So wouldn't even think that, it was possible.
Yes, and I think with especially sexual abuse, it does have such a long-term impact because she said that she didn't ever tell her husband, but she'd never enjoyed the sexual side of her marriage. And when she had her children, she said it really impacted. She was never able to breastfeed because it triggered off so many memories.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's very personal, sensitive stuff that some women carry to the grave. Mm. never having spoken about it.
Mm.
And some of the women
you've given some, so you've given some of those the sense of being believed and a voice.
Yes, that's
beautiful.
Right. Yes, yes.
Lovely. And I always find it interesting, Tess, in a lot of the interviews I've done for the podcast, how something that happened 20 or 30 years ago in a job or something that you did just lead you to, like, you look back and say, it all the roads just, and it makes sense, but it's so powerful, really, how the little decisions that you've made along the way for where you worked and the love of writing just happened to land you in the centre where you got to write and do the child protection.
Yeah.
You know, all of that has led you now to be able to do this really powerful storytelling as well on behalf of other women. So,
yes. I think sometimes we do need to look back and start to realise how things connect.
Mm.
Because even when I went for my job, while I was at university, I couldn't do hairdressing because it just didn't fit in with school children.
Mm.
And I had no family here to help me. And so I was a checkout chick at Coles, which was really good because it helped me put petrol in the car to get to Queensland Uni, and so I go along for a job in the department thinking, well, what have I really done? I can't tell them I was a checkout chick, you know. But the thing is, once I said I haven't really done much, but she said, you know, look, there's no woman who can say that. This was the interviewer, you know. And then, of course, I said, oh, well, I was actually the jams and pickles lady at the school fete every year. So I organised that, and then I became the Devonshire tea lady at the high school. And suddenly I realised that, you know, I have done things.
Yeah. It's all transferable skills, I like to say.
That's what she said. That's transferable. It means you can actually organise yourself. And
time management and all of that.
And organise a few people who help me with my jams and pickles.
It's so true. We underestimate the skill level that we have. I remember years ago a woman saying to me in the workplace, women, they used to, or hopefully they don't so much now, but talk about a gap out of the workforce when you were parenting, which is still a job, clearly. But they'd say, you know, the skills you learned during that time are transferable skills because you are learning time management. Wrangling children is a big skill
that
you can take into the workplace.
So, and democracy and diplomacy.
Absolutely. Never underestimate the skills that you learn parenting. Yeah, absolutely. So I just wondered if you'd like to read, before we finish, if you want to read a little poem for us to finish from your poetry book, if that's okay, Tess?
No, that's thank you for asking, because I've got a poem that I actually wrote this book during COVID. It was a sort of an exercise in producing my own book. And so I did the artwork on the cover, which is the most beautiful daisies, isn't it?
Gorgeous.
And so I illustrated the cover in a very simple way. I'm not a great artist, but a collection of my poetry, one third humorous, one third about family life, kids, pets and friends, and one third about things happening, like the Bartel Godwits on Wynnum Esplanade and the migrating birds. So it's a book of a variety, and I've segmented them into three parts. So one poem that I think you might enjoy, because it's about a tour. When I was working in the department, we went on holiday. At that stage, it was getting very difficult in the department because we were having to start writing reports in triplicate, and it was starting to not be quite the job I'd hoped to have. And so we went to Tasmania. And for those of you listening who've been around the chocolate factory tour, I've got Alana here nodding her head.
I can smell it.
That's right. And it's the most delightful thing, especially when you've been a public servant for a number of years. And the lady who showed us around, she was called Shirley, and she was so lovely. And I thanked her afterwards because it really lifted my spirits. And I said, you know, I really appreciated what you've just given us. And she said that she'd been there 27 years and never had an unhappy moment. She just loved it. So I came out, and in the car park I wrote, I want to work at Cadbury's. I want to be like Shirl. I want to show the people round and dish out Cadbury's twirls. I'm sick of me computer of sitting at a desk. I want to work at Cadbury's, promoting Tassie's best. I'll learn me lines. I won't fudge them if our Cadbury's got started. I'll Turkish delight with all me might and flake the chocolate-hearted. My paper hat I'll wear with pride. Just give me a fair go. I'll don the earmuffs honestly and put on quite a show. Now Shirley likes Jamaican dark, So I'd be no competition, because I'm a milk tray girl at heart, the soft-scented light edition. So we could work in harmony and never break the rules with Milk Freddo and Old Jamaica. We'd share the kilojoules. I'd learn a lot from Shirley, like when tourists run amok and miss the pre-appointed tour and should be out of luck. But in fine Cadbury tradition, Shirley would always let them stay. She'd put them into our group and never turn them away. Her 27 happy years at Cadbury's is good news. I realised that no one else would ever fill her shoes. So put me on production, pushing chocolates by the mile. And as the tourists straggle by, I'd flash me brightest smile, watching the conveyor belts round cherry ripes with ease. And I'd learn all the latest slogans like, make it Cadbury's, please. Or put me in the chocolate shop. I could be a checkout chick. Inhaling all that chocolate air would keep me sharp and slick. Or perhaps the promotions department has a need for wit and rhyme. I would be a walking advertisement of the very finest kind. Please let me work at Cadbury's. I'm out of bed by 7. I could ride me bike to Claremont and be in 7th heaven.
Beautiful. I love it. I love it. Thank you. Thank you for your time today and for sharing your story. And I'm looking forward to seeing your book go gangbusters with sales. Thanks,
Thank you
Tess.
Very much, Alana. Thank you to the listeners.